Today is October the 25th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and I'm in the studio of the Progressive Radio Network. Podcasts of this program is available on PRN.FM and from our website, PCRadioshow.org. WBAI is in a membership drive tonight, and we have been preempted with a replacement program. But first, let me start off with a program alert. In the early part of this month of October, the judge had ruled against WBAI and issued a summary judgment against the station for monies owed to the Empire State Building. And WBAI, the radio station network, well, it's in dire strait, and one of the probable things that are going to happen is that we're facing a whole lot of problems. One of the probable things is that there'll be a signal swap. If there's a signal swap, that means we will no longer be on the assigned frequency of 99.5, which is a commercial frequency. It has value. And if you don't find us on that, you can always get the information from our website, which is pcradioshow.org. We will try to keep everyone alert to what's happening and where you can locate us. So that's pcradioshow.org. And we have some late-breaking news. What happened was that last night, the Hacker News website reported that there's a Bad Rabbit ransomware attack that is spreading like wildfire across Europe, and it hit 200 major companies already, most of them in Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, and Germany. And what it does is, of course, is that it came over from some social engineering. And the way they came over was way of saying you need Adobe Flash, and the download manager, of course, was the malware that brought in the program that locked up and encrypted the data. Now, we have some advice for you. It really hasn't hit the United States yet in any big way. They'll probably go after the big companies. That's where the money is, because they're asking for Bitcoins as ransom, and they just figure that the big companies is the one that would know how to do it. And for small people, they just say, okay, I'll just rebuild the system again. But our advice to you is that to avoid this, there are a couple ways of doing it. One is do not use Adobe Flash Player. I mean, if you have to, okay? I mean, if you really needed the Adobe Flash and it says you need an update on it, what you do is you do not click yes or no, because with these scamware, yes means yes and no means yes. What you do is you exit out, you know, through the taskbar and say, I'm out. And if you really need that Flash Player, go to the Adobe site itself, adobe.com. But the best thing is don't. Now, if you do need to run Adobe Flash, there's a technical piece of information that's available. It's quite detailed. So I asked our webmaster, Michael Horowitz, to post it on our website, pcradioshow.org. And I would say that for the average user, it's a fairly complex solution on how to vaccinate your computer against this ransomware. If you happen to have trustworthy friends who can do it for you, well, you're going to need them to do it. It's not something that is simple. You have to, modify or actually create some dummy files, assign some attributes to it, and then you have to go through the Microsoft bulletins on their threat bulletins and follow a number of other things that you have to do. So I would say that it's available. It's not something I would recommend for the average user. For the average user, don't use Adobe Flash. If you have to and it says there's an update, don't fall for it. Just remember now, you know, these messages that you get, I don't care who they say they are. They may say they're Microsoft. They may say they're Adobe. They may say they're the IRS. I don't really care. If they tell you to click on something, to download something, or they request information, no. And the other thing is that when you download things and programs, I know that many people are extra careful, but be careful of the double negative. What do I mean by double negative? They would say you do not want, right? which means you do one. And if it's a yes or no that you got to click, just assume that everything you click is a yes. Get out the normal way. It's no longer viruses now that people should be afraid of, because they don't use viruses anymore. They use something very simple. It's called social engineering. With social engineering, they don't care if it's a Mac. They don't care if it's a PC. They don't care if it's a Linux machine. They don't care if it's a smartphone. They'll get to you somehow. So just be on the alert for that. A big piece of news, and I when I first saw it, I says, wow, I can't believe it. A company that is, you know, it's been rated by Consumers Union or Consumers Report as being one of the better mail order companies, and I've dealt with them and never had problems with them. But Newegg is being sued for alleged Ponzi scheme. And what happened was that back in 2015, they had ordered some equipment along with another company, ASI, and what they did was they issued purchase orders for a home theater PC, and they had a series of them purchased, of course, with different options on it, ranging in price from $2,500 to $3,000. Of course, they would use these for resale, and they ordered quite a number of these with a company called Manuel. I hope I can pronounce it properly. It's M-O-N-E-U-A-L. Some of you may be familiar with them because they made a robotic vacuum cleaner many years ago. When I say vacuum cleaner, it's like a thing that moves around on the floor. And, well, a lot of money came in, and the owner of the company did not go ahead to manufacture the product. He actually didn't have the money, but with the money order, he went to 10 South Korean banks to raise the money. He got the money, but he did not spend the money to manufacture the product. And two years ago, he got taken to court. And now he's got a 23-year or 25-year prison term to serve for defrauding the banks. Now, the banks are saying, hey, wait a minute. These orders came in from two companies, one of them a very large one, Newegg, and say, hey, Newegg, issue these a large volume of orders, we're going to sue you because you ordered it and he in turn took that purchase order and you knew he couldn't do it. And Newegg is saying, what are you talking about? He says, well, this home theater PC. Now, I don't know if anyone knows what a home theater PC is. Basically, it's a media player for video and audio on your PC so that you can play back different medias, be it from TV or from DVDs and so on. And the banks claim that Newegg should have known better because when they issued the purchase order between $2,500 to $3,000 for the equipment, they should have known that the equipment for each unit only costs $8 to manufacture. Are you kidding me? Where did they get this $8 from? Now, based on the fact that they said that the home theater PC was only $8, therefore, Newegg was involved with this quote-unquote Ponzi scheme. Well, number one is it makes no sense at all. And to even think that a home theater PC would, you know, I mean, if someone said to me that, you know what, if you can sell the parts to me for $8, I'll build it myself. It's more than $8. So a statement was issued by Newegg, and they said that they pride themselves on conducting business fairly, ethically, and honestly. The company denies the allegations and the complaint filed, and Newegg intends to vigorously defend itself against these unfounded charges. I don't know. Now, the only thing that I think that Newegg could be guilty of, okay, and but, you know, we don't know, all right, is that, you know, like most companies, they have a purchasing agent or not agent, you know, someone who works in the purchasing department. They issue the purchase order. And if there was collusion with the purchasing agent, with Manorio, you know, they could say, hey, I'll give you this order and I want a kickback. That happens. But something as large as this, when you're spending millions of dollars buying the equipment, I think that the purchasing agent just can't, you know, issue a big order like that just by himself. Someone else has to sign off on it. But $8 for a home theater PC. Well, by the way, of the 10 South Korean banks, only four of them are following up on this. The other six, I think they have better sense than that. Well, let me get to another item that's hit the news that I thought that was interesting, is that China had originally, about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, banned the sale of the newly announced Apple Watch Series 3. And the reason is, what they said was that because they were having a hard time tracking users with the cellular capability. In other words, with the Apple Watch, the original one was, if you want to make a cellular call, you had to have a, you had to have the iPhone tethered either wire or wirelessly to the Apple Watch to make it work. And now with the new Apple Watch, you don't need the iPhone theoretically, and I guess for practical reasons, you should be able to make a cellular phone call from the Apple Watch. Well, I don't know what makes it work, but the Chinese government is saying, okay, you can now sell it because Apple has agreed now they have disabled the cellular capability and connectivity in the Apple Watch. So I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, that was the big announcement, and why would people want to buy the Apple Watch that you can't make phone calls from, which was really the big upgrade? I don't know. Someone said to me, the Chinese government tracking the people, if they don't they track the people on an iPhone? I mean, like, you know, with the iPhone with GPS and so on. Well, apparently the Chinese government were able to take the technology in the iPhone and be able to track people. But with the new architecture that was put into the Apple Watch, maybe they haven't had time to do it yet. So, you know, the question I ask is a very simple one. Suppose I'm a visitor and I have an Apple Watch that has a cellular connected to it and it's working, and I happen to be a tourist in China. Gee, I wonder if it would work. The truth is, I wouldn't try it because I'm in foreign land and I don't want to be stuck. Another thing is that, you know, last week we were talking about the Supreme Court has accepted a case to be heard, and they probably won't come up with a judgment on it until sometime next spring, which is like almost a year away, or maybe a little bit less than a year away. And this is with Microsoft, where Microsoft has servers in Ireland, and the Justice Department says, hey, we want email or we want data that you have on the server. Now, Microsoft said, no, you can't. So they went to the Supreme Court, and now they're going to, have it heard. And the court justices will hopefully come up with something that, you know, makes sense. But Google got hit with the same thing. And instead of saying, okay, you know, depending on the outcome of that Supreme Court case, Google has the Justice Department is asking Google to say you will be fined each day until the judgment rendered is whether you are guilty or not guilty. And the Google said, okay, you want to fine us? Now, remember, Gmail, that's a whole lot of mail. And I'm saying to myself, the supposition being made by our government is that they know how much mail they want each day from Google with the email stored in, on a server on foreign soil. To me, it makes no sense at all. In other words, you're guilty because I know I'm going to be getting, serving you with a court order for email. You know, it's sort of like, don't we wait until things happen before you say, here's the court order? They're saying, oh, no, we will be doing it. It makes no sense at all. And, Google said, all right, we'll agree to some amount of money that we'll be fined each day, and the money will accumulate until the judgment comes. Well, Google said they'd be willing to put aside $10,000 a day. And, of course, this is per day. In 10 days, that's $100,000. And by the time the judgment comes out, we're in the millions, all right? Well, the federal government says not enough money. We want you to be fined more than that, more than $10,000 a day. Well, the judge says no, $10,000 is if Google is agreeable to it, that's it. Now, this is in the San Francisco District Court. My own feeling on this is that this I think it has no merit at all. I mean, you know, number one is I think that if you really by the way, the government case is very simple. They say that you have access to the data on foreign soil. Therefore, you can give us the information. You know what this is like saying? We've been hearing the government talking about we have $2.5 trillion, maybe $4 trillion sitting overseas. Hey, you know what? The American corporation has access to that money. They could easily just do an electronic transfer of that money to the United States. Well, how's that different from email messages? So the argument is, well, since you have electronic connectivity to access it, therefore, we don't consider it to be on foreign soil. Well, let's see how the Supreme Court will rule on that, because the Supreme Court says it's what is the letter of the law, and foreign soil is foreign soil. You just can't just convolute the idea that because you can access it, foreign soil is now domestic soil. Oh, boy. By the way, there was another item that came out that I found extremely interesting. And because one of the listeners had originally contacted me and he was interested, he says, Linux, what's the interest in Linux in China? And what is the leading version of Linux being used in China? And I know I've been following this is because in China, they're trying to move away from two things. They're trying to move away from Microsoft Windows, and they're trying to move away from Microsoft Office. And they just want to be able to have better control over it. They want to be able to not spend all that money. Of course, you know, they want us to be able to buy things from China, made in China. And, you know, but when it comes to, you know, doing trade in the opposite direction, they prefer not to spend the money. So what China has done is that they've been working with the China Standard Software Company, and they came up with what is called NeoKylin, N-E-O-K-Y-L-I-N. It's a version of Linux, and I looked at it, and I was kind of surprised because a number of organizations have looked at it, and they said, you know, that is a knockoff of Windows XP. And I said to myself, well, Windows XP, one reason why they want a knockoff of Windows XP is because 27% of the installed base, and this is based on internet access. When you access the internet, they know what kind of equipment you have. They even know whether, you know, the model number and so on. Maybe people don't realize that. And the 27% of the installed base, and I'm sure that there's much more equipment than that, that is you know, not accessing the internet. Because I know that in the United States, the claim is that Windows XP installed base is like 11, 12% now. No, it's higher than that. Because there are a lot of medical equipment that is still running Windows XP. They're running with vertical applications. And because they're running vertical applications, they don't go out to the internet at all. And if they're connected, it's to an internal network that has nothing to do, and they separate this from any external networks because of HIPAA laws. In other words, patient information, you got to protect it. So, and I said to myself, gee, Windows XP, that means that they're, you know, are they still ordering it or not? Well, it turns out that I was a little surprised by that. 40% of commercial PCs sold by Dell, which, by the way, is the third largest PC manufacturer, In the case of HP, they're 21% of the market of PCs. Lenovo is about 19.5%, and Dell is about 14-15%. So they still have a hefty number. But 40% of the commercial PCs sold by Dell in China is installed with Neo Kylin. That's a big number. And supposedly, the Chinese government is slowly but surely adopting Neo Kylin as the standard operating system. However, I thought about it and I says, gee, is this really true? And I said to myself, well, I have no empirical data on this, but if I were a Chinese company, I would buy a PC with Neo Kylin in store. And by the way, there are reports that we don't know the numbers, but many of these PCs are then reinstalled with pirated copies of, guess what, Windows XP. And I said to Joe, my colleague, I said, you know what, I don't think it's going to take hold for a couple of reasons. He says, why not? Well, you know, one of the things I rail about is the H-1B program. The H-1B program, when it was initially initiated back in the 1994 and in that time frame, was because the United States was supposedly short of skilled labor, and it was meant to bring in skilled labor that we don't have. The other was that with people with perhaps more detailed knowledge or superior knowledge in a certain field or a specialty, we want them. Well, as like anything else, like a slippery slope, that's not the case now. 50% of H-1B people now only have a high school degree from overseas. Now, you can't tell me that these people from a high school, with only a high school a background, they have a skill that we don't have. And I can prove that very easily. You know, it was a couple of weeks, a couple of years ago, maybe 2 years ago, Disney had laid off the entire IT staff and was over 200 people, and they replaced them completely with, H-1B people. And as a for them to qualify for the severance pay, they had to train these people. So obviously, these people that being replaced them did not here because we have no one, the claim that you always hear about H-1B, well, there's no one that can do the job, no one willing to do the job. Baloney. There's a lot of people willing to do the job, all right? And, of course, why did Disney do it? Because they were able to pay 25 to 30%, less in pay. And not only can they pay less, but the benefits they also give less because they are contracted to a third party. Well, I do know that when I was visiting China a number of years ago, and I was surprised to hear it, is that the students there, if you want to graduate from high school, you have to be proficient in U.S. English language. In other words, the U.S. high school equivalent for English, you had to be proficient in it. That means that they all are well versed in English, and if they want to come over here on H-1B, now tell me, okay, how many of them are going to say, "I know Windows XP," and that's going to give them a leg up, or they're going to say, "Oh no, I know Windows 7 or 10," that's what they're going to say. And the other thing is that the government contracted with the China Standard Software is to develop a office product called NeoShine, which is basically open office expanded with the Chinese language attached to it. You know what? If you come over here, I've used Open Office, I've used Microsoft Office. Yes, I can use both. But the navigation is not the same. The concept is not the same. And I was surprised that they did not adopt Kingsoft or WPS, which is really a version of a Kingsoft, to run on Linux, because there is a version of that. And the reason is because the government doesn't want to. They want to just be able to say, you know, we run, you know, we're going to have our own. But I just feel that anyone in China, they'll somehow get a either pirated copy of Microsoft Office or a knockoff of a Microsoft Office like Kingsoft. And somehow they're going to find Windows 10, Windows 7, and they want to be part of that H-1B program. You know, we talk about 11 million, quote unquote, people that come over. They're not immigrants legally, but as defined. But we have 11 million people there here that, and we all think of them as being from Mexico. They're not. Easily 3 to 4 million are not from Mexico. They're from Asia. They're from China. They're from India. They're from other parts of the world. They're in the technical field. And so I have a bias on that. By the way, Joe had mentioned to me, I had told him about a listener, and he said this listener had contacted me about a machine, and he said that he was running, and all of a sudden he can't run anymore, and something's wrong, and no matter what he does, he installed new drivers, it didn't work. He reinstalled the program, it didn't work. And I said to him, and this is strictly a guess, I said, you probably had a Windows update. And with the Windows update, you don't know if the Windows update was installed properly. So use Windows Restore, System Restore, go back to a point in time where it was working, and restore the system. Now, when you do a System Restore, although it does not change the data, I recommend that you do a backup on the data first before you do it, just to be on the sure side. Do a System Restore back to that point, and you should be able to run. I also tell people that if they, not on ransomware now, okay, but on if they feel that they've been hit with malware, just go back to the point it was working, and it'll just go, because it modifies whatever was done to the system. And that's the way you should do it. And a footnote on that is, he was able to just recover, and he says, but what was wrong? And that brings up to the point of, when I look at solving a problem, yes, I could take the time out to find out what caused the problem, or I can say, how do I quickly resolve the problem? I learned this lesson when I first started working. One of my jobs was, in the early days of work, was working for a bank. And when I worked for the bank, I just made the assumption that everyone stayed into the late hours until everything balanced out to the penny. And I remember my boss then says, no, we don't do that. Whatever the difference is, we plug it. I says, what do you mean by plug? What is a plug? Oh, whatever the difference is, we just say, okay, this is the difference. And each day, you know, we add or subtract, you know, to the plug. And, you know, whatever that differential is at the end of the year, that's our, you know, cost of doing business with that plug. And he said to me, if you keep the people working overtime to balance everything out to the penny, you know what? The labor cost on that far exceeds the cost of the plug. So I took that concept in solving problems that I look at and say, it's not necessarily trying to identify what the problem is, but why don't we just quickly get you back to the point where you can get up and running again. So that's what I've been doing. And so I hope that I always tell Joe, go back to basics, okay? Find out how you can do things and, you know, do it quickly. Now, for the second half hour, we have a couple of interesting segments, and I am putting in my 2 cents in, and I created a segment called crowdfunding. And I think you'd be interested on what my thoughts on crowdfunding is, because I got some strong thoughts on it. So let's get to that. For the second half hour, we have Dr. Alfred Paul with his presentation on wearable and health technology. I will be doing overview of crowdfunding, my one man's point of view on it. And for home automation, I asked Marty Winston to comment on Halloween and his 40-year maintenance-free house. We have in the wearable and health technology segment by Dr. Alfred Paul segments on AI on the smartphone to deal with depression. He has another segment on the temporary tattoo for early skin cancer detection. And finally, he has a segment on helping seniors to live safely alone.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. 16.1 million adults aged 18 or older in the United States. What do they all have in common? They've all had at least one major depressive episode in 2015. Depression can turn into a chronic illness if not treated effectively. The problem is that while medication and therapy can help, a lot of people either feel that they can't afford it, or they don't have the time, or there's the stigma involved in getting therapy for depression. And so a lot of people who need the treatment don't get it. Well, a startup in Bangalore, India, a company called Touchkin, has created a program called WYSA, W-Y-S-A. And basically, it's a chat bot that runs on a smartphone and allows a user to interact with this artificial intelligence engine that's designed to provide empathic conversations and engage users through the application. It uses a combination of different techniques, including cognitive behavioral techniques. It also uses the phone's sensors to try to keep track of the user's activity levels, whether they're sleeping well, and other factors that could indicate a higher risk of depression. The interesting thing about this program is that users can talk to WYSA anonymously. Their data is not traceable to an individual, and it's also encrypted in its transmission. Your sessions can even be password protected if you want. So the point of this application is to provide access to support and therapy for those who might not otherwise be able to afford it or feel that they want to interact with a human being about it. It provides clinically validated mental health support, and it should help make lives better of people with depression. Now that summer has passed, it may seem that this is the wrong season to bring up this topic, but a big health problem in this country is skin cancer. More than 76,000 people in the U.S. were diagnosed with melanoma in 2014, and almost 10,000 people died from it. There's a lot of ways that you can track how much exposure you're getting to the UV light and sunlight, which is the main contributing factor to many skin cancers. Well, a company called Logic Inc. has created a temporary tattoo that you can wear, and this is different than some of the other UV sensors that are available in that it provides two kinds of information. One, it shows you what your current exposure is to UV emissions, but it also shows you your cumulative exposure. So the problem with exposure is it's, you know, whether you're out in the bright light and receiving intense sunlight, but also over time, you want to control your exposure because it's that cumulative effect that can also increase your chances of getting cancer. The tattoo changes color based on the amount of exposure, and so you can tell with a simple glance just how much you've had. The product is not available for sale yet, but if you go to the company's website, you can sign up to be notified when it finally comes to the market. If you've listened to these segments long enough, you know that one of the topics that I'm very interested in is aging in place, technology that can help seniors continue to live safely and independently in their own homes. Well, there's new research coming out of Kyoto University in Japan, supported by Panasonic, and basically they've developed a radar-like device that can actually monitor the vital signs of a person in a room. The beauty of this is that it's wireless, and it just sits on the shelf and you don't have to do anything. One of the problems with wearables and other kinds of solutions is the person has to put it on, it may need to be recharged, so you have to remember to recharge it again. And a lot of the times people just get tired of them and don't bother fussing with them anymore. This radar approach actually means that you don't even have to think about it. It will just sit there and can automatically monitor the vital signs of the person in the room. They've been working very hard at making it smaller and smaller. Its original size was about the size of a microwave oven, but now they've got it down to about the size of a large tablet, and they're probably going to be able to shrink it even further. The goal is they'd like to have a device that is small enough that it could be incorporated in normal ceiling lighting, and so that every room could be equipped with this kind of sensor. So this could end up being a very convenient and reliable way to track the activity level, keep track of the vital signs, detect falls, and provide other support for the elderly living in their own homes. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Traditionally, a startup company prepares a business plan that is presented to venture capitalists for funding. When funding is raised through a public offering, it needs to be registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. However, crowdfunding to raise funds for a startup has become the popular vehicle, which bypasses the Securities and Exchange Commission. Crowdfunding in the technology sector accounts for a third of all crowdfunding activity. When you add to that related products in the consumer sector, this accounts for 44% of all crowdfunding. Well, what is crowdfunding? By definition, it's a way of raising finance by asking a large number of people each for a small amount of money. The biggest and popular crowdfunding sites are Indiegogo and Kickstarter. Indiegogo offers reward crowdfunding and equity crowdfunding, whereas Kickstarter offers donation reward crowdfunding, all or nothing. There are different types of crowdfunding. With the donation reward crowdfunding, people invest simply because they believe in the cause. Rewards can be offered. Donors have a social or personal motivation for putting their money in and expecting nothing back. Debt crowdfunding is a little different. Investors receive their money back with interest, and returns are financial. Equity crowdfunding is when people invest in an opportunity in exchange for equity, and money is exchanged for a share or a small stake in the business, if it's successful. Now, what's the difference between Indiegogo and Kickstarter? Kickstarter releases funds only after the campaign reaches its funding goal. Indiegogo provides you with an opportunity to choose between receiving funding as it comes in or waiting to see if you hit your target. If you reach your goal, Indiegogo takes 4% cut. If you don't, the fee jumps to 9%. Kickstarter backers are never charged when a project misses its goal. Kickstarter fees are 5% of total funds raised. Payment processing fees are 20 cents per pledge. Furthermore, out of 140,000 plus projects that have ended on Indiegogo, only 9.3% raise 100% of their goals or higher. By contrast, 46% of Kickstarter campaigns fail to raise more than 20% of their goal, and 80% of Indiegogo projects fail to raise more than a quarter of their goal. Kickstarter is available only in the United States, Canada, and the UK, whereas Indiegogo has campaigns in 200 countries. Less than a third of crowdfunding campaigns reach their goals. Between 69 and 89% of projects, depending on the platform, fail to reach their targets, according to a new report from the London-based markets research firm, Crowdfunding Center. Kickstarter saw 31% of its campaign reach their fundraising goal, and that was the highest success rate among the five crowdfunding platforms in their study. What is startling is how much is raised with a successful Kickstarter project, and this is all based on the most recent updated stats, the end of July of this year. Average amount raised is, on a successful project, $21,698, and the median, which is where most of the money is raised, is in the amount of $5,050. So the net of what are we saying? There is no oversight on crowdfunding. Most crowdfunding projects never see the light of day on the delivery of product or service. If the goal is not reached with Kickstarter, the money is returned, and in the case of Indiegogo, there is no return of money if the goal is not met. It just seems that with Indiegogo, the person seeking venture funding, he wins whether or not the goal is reached, because he keeps what can be raised. For many who have succeeded getting funding for their project, they come back to crowdfunding for more money. The initial seed money only enabled them to create the product. This needs follow-up for manufacture and product rollout. Many are relying on social media to get exposure for the product. They have not developed a business plan to include cost of customer acquisition and advertising. More important is they have not asked themselves the important questions. Who is the audience for the product? What is the functional need for the product? Is the product cost-effective? Many of these products is just marrying the smartphone to a manual device. I can easily readjust the temperature of the thermostat without a smartphone. I can open the refrigerator door to see what's left in the refrigerator without using a smartphone. But they argue that the benefit of this type of automation is you can do it remotely. Ask yourself, how many times do you readjust the thermostat? So, you've been forewarned. If you're not concerned with whether or not there is a product or service, but you want to participate in crowdfunding of a project, well, go right ahead and spend the money. But what say you? You can send me your 2 cents at hank@pcradioshow.org, and I just may follow up with feedback from the audience on how they feel about crowdfunding. On the home automation front, well, it's Halloween coming up, and I said, Marty, what can we do for Halloween? And he's got a segment on Halloween and the 40-year maintenance-free house.
In our 40-year house project, that's 40yearhouse.com, I want you to think about this. If we're going to make a structure that can survive without needing major repairs or replacements for 40 years, it has to survive 40 Halloweens.
More work.
That doesn't mean that there's nothing to be frightened of. In fact, there are some things that we find quite scary.
You're right.
First among those is sunlight. Sunlight, not because we burst into flames or the house, but sunlight because of how much it heats the structure, costing energy, costing protection, and costing UV fading, ultraviolet fading on the things that we want to look vivid. Sunlight is scary, but it's not the only thing.
But this isn't science. It's more like black magic. You think I'm mad. Perhaps I am.
There's also townspeople with torches or anything else in the neighborhood that's burning. Burning buildings, burning trees, grass fires, brush fires, pine straw catching fire. Because it's really hard to detect outside fires. We can do a lot inside the house in detecting smoke and fires. Outside, that's a challenge we're still working to solve. So there's sunlight and townspeople with torches. And now there's wolves. Wolves. Unless it's Hugh Jackman, because my wife's a huge fan of Hugh Jackman. Wolves or coyotes that might threaten our pets, or deer that might threaten plantings, or, well, you know, bats. Bats are fine. They eat insects that are pests. We have something in mind for the wolves, the coyotes, the deer, that may discourage them from hanging around. We're working on a pursuit drone, a drone that can take coordinates from our surveillance system when there's an intruder in the yard and go into a follow-me selfie mode. Not so much for the video we can take, because the surveillance system will already have that, because this that's circling you is going to kind of discourage you from sticking around, whether you're human or deer or coyote or wolf. Then there's ghouls. Not the ones who come out of the graveyard, the ones who enter through the internet to try to devour the brains and the bodies of our computers and assets. The ghouls of ransomware. The ghouls of Russian hackers. We want to keep them at bay, and a sprig of garlic ain't gonna do it. And, of course, lightning! Because it can knock down trees, which can not be good if they fall against the house or anywhere else for that matter. They can put holes in the house. They can knock out power. Okay, so what are we afraid of? We're afraid of sunlight, townspeople with torches, wolves, ghouls, lightning. Oh my. And what are we going to do about it? Okay, for sunlight, the first thing we're doing is making the eaves of the roof wider than normal. And that gives us extra time in shadow for the sides of the house and the windows. Every time we go out a few more inches, we gain minutes and minutes of additional shading. That helps reduce it. Also, metallic roof with a gap underneath or any kind of insulation underneath helps reflect and deflect, and the separation helps stop thermal coupling into the attic. So the sunlight heating factors kind of go away. The UV fading is something we address in the selection of materials, both for the roofing and for the walls, the outer walls, the sheathing, the things that might look like stone but are really formed coverings. Townspeople with torches and outdoor fires, what we're looking at, what we're pursuing right now, and I'm open to any better idea, is taking a look at expanded spectrum video. If we overlay the visible light with infrared, I'm not sure near or far is more appropriate. I'm still doing the homework. Maybe a little ultraviolet. Maybe we can find something that locates, at least as an azimuth, as you know, which direction to it, anything outside that might be a flame. Once that happens, we can direct our surveillance to look at it. We can go look at it, or at least be more aware that there might be a threat. I'd rather know than not know. I think you would too, even if it's townspeople with torches. Wolves and deer and coyotes, you want to keep them at bay. As I mentioned, the idea of having a follow-me selfie mode on a drone, it would be well overhead to clear the trees, but it's circling, and it is buzzing. Those things are not stealth mode, are they? We have that drone up there. Deer don't like to stick around for that. Wolves are loners. They don't like to be hearing strange things. Coyotes are pack animals, and the pack will tend to run. Wolves are pack animals, and then they're also both wolves and coyotes can be loners. So just a matter of trying to, trying to intimidate them a little bit, trying to help them find other targets. In terms of the bad things that come over the internet, we're simply not connecting most of the control systems to the internet. The ones that we do are very nicely isolated. It's like trying to see what's inside a thermos bottle, inside a safe, inside a locked building, in terms of what we're doing with our network security. Lightning, several things here. If it knocks down a tree and hits the house, I don't have a countermeasure for that other than homeowner's insurance. If it puts a hole in the roof, part of that is me. And by having good grounding and multiple points of grounding and a lot of shared grounding connected to air terminals, which is the modern name for lightning rods and for the metallic roof itself, I can divert a lot of that. The air terminals help kind of deflate the charge clouds that attract lightning, and it's good for that. If necessary, if it's a strike, they'll be the sacrificial beings that grab the current and send it to ground. So lightning hitting the house, lightning making holes in the house, those are things, again, if it's unavoidable, there's homeowner's insurance, but a lot of it's avoidable by doing good lightning protection and good grounding. And then there's a whole idea of what happens when the power goes out. Well, the first thing that happens is our backup systems kick in to keep everything alive for the few minutes it takes for the second thing that happens, and that's a gas-powered generator kicking in. While the generator is running, the UPS systems recharge, so if the gas generator needs to come down for periodic maintenance or an adjustment or what have you, there is time again on the UPSs to allow that to happen for the few minutes those activities take, and bang, we're back and up and running. It should be, by and large, a no-interruption house, depending on how we scale the generator, which is pretty much close to 20 kVA, and how we scale the use of other things within the house. These are things that in a closed-loop system we can monitor. We can take a look at how much power is actually being required. We can also take a look at tables of how much power these things run if we don't want to do a live measurement because they are known things. And we can selectively include circuitry to shut them off if they really don't need to run during an outage, and also to override that by trading off other things that could be off if they have to run. It's just management, and with the computers we have, not a terribly daunting task as long as we remember to do it. Well, those are the tricks that we have against sunlight making you burst into flames, or at least get a little warmer, against townspeople with torches, against wolves, against ghouls, against lightning, and against everything else that, as Hank says, makes you want to back up, a back up, a back up.
More work.
Happy Halloween.
Thank you, Marty. Hey, Marty, are you talking about a 40-year maintenance-free haunted house? Nah, I know you're kidding, right? Public service announcements. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the Bundle Hyper-V virtual machine program in Windows 8, 8.1, and 10. Thursday, October the 26th, 6:45 p.m., they'll meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on cybersecurity. Thursday, November the 2nd, 7 p.m., they'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a meeting on Friday, November the 3rd, 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue, in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on 3D design and printing, Tuesday, November the 7th, 7:30 p.m., at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. New York Amateur Computer Club will have their main meeting on Thursday, November the 9th, 7 p.m., at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401, Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on Friday, November the 10th, 7 p.m., at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, Auditorium of the Harry J. Shore Hall. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on new tech toys, December the 5th, which is a Tuesday, at 1:30 p.m., Community Room 999, Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. And all these meetings are open to the public. There's no charge to attend these meetings, and we hope to see you there. And for other club meetings that I might have missed, just let me know at hank@pcradioshow.org and let me know where the meeting is going to be held, what time, what date, and what the topic may be. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and keep cool until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.